give the word to Hagit.
Yeah, sure. So, good morning, everyone. We'll start with agenda paper one. So, I'll provide a short introduction of the paper. So, we have received a submission about whether IFRS 17 permits the separation of insurance contracts, components of a single insurance contract for measurement purposes. That submission states that insurers usually combine risks together or different coverages together to form one legal contract. One of the examples is that we have a 10-year life contract with renewable health riders for 1 year. We also received another submission that talks about reinsurance contracts held and whether there is a requirement or permission to separate the measurement of reinsurance contracts held to reflect the several underlying insurance contracts. So these are two different submissions that we have addressed in this paper. In the review of the accounting analysis in the paper, you can find the staff conclusions about how we think the words in the standard work and apply to that specific questions. If you look at this analysis, you will see that the staff has concluded that the lowest unit of account that is used under IFRS 17 is the contract that includes all insurance components. We also note that it is expected that entities usually design the contract in a way that reflects their substance. Therefore, a contract with a legal form of a single contract would usually reflect its substance. And we also know that we acknowledge that there could be circumstances where the legal form of a single contract would not reflect the substance of the contractual rights and obligations under that contract. And therefore, it might be that we will override this presumption that the contract is the lowest unit of account. We also know that overriding this presumption is a matter of analyzing all the facts and circumstances and applying judgment. With that brief summary, I will hand it over to you to reflect upon the accounting analysis that we have provided for these two submissions.
Okay. Who will start?
John?
Thank you, Martin Edelman. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jung Hyuk Park from Samsung Life. You can just call me JP from now on through this discussion. Let me briefly explain what I think about this issue. And I support the staff's view that separation is not permitted under IFRS 17, which is view A. IFRS 17 does not provide specific requirements on separating insurance components. Therefore, the lowest unit of account is a contract that includes all insurance components. Nevertheless, if some insurance components have to be separated to represent economic substance of a specific product, I think it is enough to consider the conceptual framework, which provides criteria for combination and separation. Even when the framework is applied to separation of insurance components, I think in the case of a long-term base plan contract with multiple renewable riders given in Appendix A, it is appropriate to treat the contracts that includes multiple insurance riders as a single unit of account. More importantly, I fully support Steph's view that when applying contract boundary paragraph to that long-term base plan with the renewable riders, the cash flows within the boundary of each contract in the group would be assessed for each contract in its entirety. In this case, because of reasons that Steph pointed out, the entity does not have enough capacity to reflect risks at the entire contract level at each renewal date of riders. Therefore, the contract is longer than a year, and there is only one contract boundary for that product. In other words, the contract is not split by the components to determine the contract boundary of each component as if they were issued as a separate contract. That's my preliminary views on this issue.
Okay, thanks for that, Leslie.
I have a question on your comment on the boundary.
Yes.
Does the fact that the boundary is long, does that require us then to project the possible election of a rider if somebody doesn't currently have the rider? I understand what you're saying about a contract that has a rider. The cash flows for the renewals of those riders are within the contract boundary. That's your position, right? Or that's your thought?
Yes.
What I'm wondering is if a contract hasn't currently got that rider but has the option to elect the rider at some point in the future, are we obligated to make an assumption about the future election? I mean, I understand that the impact on the carrying value of the liability would be zero, so that wouldn't be a problem. However, there might be a CSM and the requirement to separately disclose the risk adjustment and the CSM from the future cash flows could mean that there is that requirement. I'm a little concerned about the conjectural nature of it's bad enough that we have to estimate all the future assumptions to get an appropriate CSM or to get the appropriate liability for a component of the contract that exists, but to add the conjectural projection of whether someone will elect to add that rider seems to be a lot.
I just pointed out the argument from this product illustrated in this example. In this illustrated example, they said that long-term contract is issued with the multiple riders. But the multiple riders has the option of renewable by policyholders, not the insurer. So in that case, we need to determine whether that the contract boundary for renewal options, renewable riders can be prolonged or can be stopped by the criteria of contract boundary paragraphs.
Yeah,
when we determining those kind of decisions, we need to look at the cash flows at the entity level, not the component level. That's what I'm saying here at this point.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. My question was a follow-up question. Is a corollary, therefore, that you need to anticipate whether or not people will elect to add that rider to their policy in future?
And I think that is maybe a different question, which was,
yeah,
I think, not addressed in this paper, but it's a good question, right?
Thank you.
Kevin.
Thank you, Martin. I thought it was interesting that JP said that he supported the staff's view, which was view A. I think when I read the paper, I thought the staff's view was view C, which I think is one of the possible challenges with the paper, is that you can read it sort of two ways. I'm in favor of UC because I think that using a principles-based approach to determine whether in substance these two contracts is helpful. I think it also ties in with the guidance you've given around combination of contracts. The problem I had was with paragraph 20, which I think is where you basically you've got a rebuttable presumption that if you wrote something in one contract, then you meant to put them in one contract. I think that possibly takes it too far, and I think that you could stick with the examples in paragraph 19 as these are the kinds of things you should consider, but that you should still just stick with the principle that it's a substance over form issue, and there could be cases, given there's so many different types of contracts, where either the timing or the pricing or the way it's managed actually means that there is in substance more than one obligation or contract in a single document.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. Then we have Joe.
Support view C. I do know that different people reading the paper were not that clear on exactly what was supported. I think my concern was how you think about and describe substance, because I do think a combined contract has substance. We write very many combined contracts, and it's very much the direction of travel. The key strategy at the minute is to, thinking about the customer, what is their insurance needs. The insurance, the customer wants their entire insurance needs to be covered, and if that can be done in one contract, then that is simpler for them, and that's what we're working towards. So both for we're working towards it for individual customers, where they could have life and GI cover in one contract. There's various regulatory stuff behind that that needs to be worked through, so we're not there yet. We are starting, we are going to be launching some products soon which are combined contracts. Now, they are very much, the front end is combined from the customer's perspective, the back end is completely separate, and it's reserved for separately and it's measured separately. You know, it would make absolute sense to separate it. The interactions between the components, they tend to be not that material in nature. They are, you know, around discounts, but they're not discounts that we wouldn't also provide if people have more than one contract with us. You know, acquisition costs and, you know, degree of allocation, it's not difficult to separate. And we already write a lot of single contracts, but with combined components for SME customers, where a small business, they want some commercial property cover, they want some employer liability cover, they might want fleet cover. They're all very separate components. They're measured separately. They're managed. The risks are managed separately, but we put them together because that's the relationship we have with the customer, and it's easier for them to sign one bit of paper than many. So I think I didn't like how you were describing substance, because I don't think those contracts don't have substance, but the substance is they're designed to meet the customer's needs, and there are a number of components that are built together that could be sold separately, and different components are bolted together as is the customer's need. So I think you see.
But would you say that is then one contract, or is only several contracts are combined in one document? And
it's one contract.
One contract.
It's one contract.
Francesco?
Thank you. I'd like to start actually by asking a question to the ISB members and staff, because this is such a fundamental point, and you have covered that quite clearly in IFRS 15 for contracts with customers. At Deloitte, we felt that if you didn't write it in IFRS 17, there was a reason. So based on that, I would be in alignment with JP and saying, well, they haven't written it, so it's not there. But maybe you can tell us why there was no writing of it, why in February, when this matter was brought in the sweep issues, there was a kind of a non-clear conclusion that no further guidance was necessary to be added to IFRS 17. I tried to read in the basic conclusion whether there was an explanation about that, and I couldn't find a satisfactory explanation, so I was planning to ask the question first, and then on the premise that at the moment my preliminary view is that I would feel UA is the most appropriate conclusion. Maybe I can change my mind, but at the moment, without that piece of information, it's difficult to rationalize what to do, given that this is such a fundamental issue about accounting for contracts.
Yeah, so I can start addressing that. So first of all, in terms of the views, and I hear that some of you say view A and view C, I can explain why we included our analysis this way and we didn't say a view. It's because view A says the separation is not permitted in IFRS 17. IFRS 17 does not permit or require or prohibit anything. IFRS 17 talks about accounting for a contract. In order to apply IFRS 17, we first need to identify what a contract is. So this is why it's not exactly view A. It might be the outcome many times, but it's not view A. You also say view C. I think the only reason that I didn't kind of point out that it's view C, because it says view C, separation is permitted using a principle-based approach. For me, sorry, as an accountant, permitted sounds like a policy choice, and I obviously did not think that this is a matter of choice. It's a matter of applying judgment, looking at all relevant facts and circumstances. In terms of IFRS 15, I think maybe Andrea can provide more background about when we drafted the standard, but it is different standard. IFRS 15 talks about performance obligation. We look at insurance contract as one big performance obligation. Because of the interaction between different risks, because every guarantee has an impact on other cash flows, so this is our starting point as a contract. It is different standard, but Do you have anything to add?
I don't think we want to get onto IFRS 15 on the fly. Yeah.
Sorry?
I don't think we want to start talking about 15 on the fly.
Okay, that's fine.
But I would have thought that paragraph 20 probably encapsulates at least part of the answer, and Daryl probably can speak more authoritatively, but I think the basic idea is what's articulated in paragraph 20. The starting assumption is a single documented contract is the unit of account, but the paper acknowledges that sometimes, for the reasons that I think Joe was describing, maybe you'd look beyond that.
And I think I was probably going to come in after Kevin's comments, what spurred me to want to come in. I think, Francesca, you're correct. You're absolutely correct in saying that the IFRS 17 is about the contract. The only circumstances in which you would deviate from the contract is if the substance is that this thing is actually not a single contract, but there are multiple contracts. And when I looked at paragraph 20, I thought paragraph 20 is quite an important paragraph. Kevin, coming back to your point, I think 20 is quite important because essentially what it does is says start with the contract. If there and the presumption, and I think Joe, you covered it to a certain extent. The presumption is if I've written a single contract with multiple things in, I intended it to be a single contract. If there are reasons why it's not, then you look for that, but it is a case of it's almost your starting point should always be the contract first, and then you look to see whether something else drives a view that's different. And I thought the 2021 interplay is quite important to this conclusion.
And also to add something from my perspective, because I have heard always, also from the industry, saying, okay, we should not split up cash flows in a contract. That is too difficult, we can't do that. If we have a contract, we should account for the contract and not looking, is it a guarantee, and account for the guarantee different from the insurance component and different from the investment components. We should look at one contract and look at the cash flows of this contract. And that was, I think, also the guidance and think the reason why we think, okay, it should be account for the contract and not looking into details even further. Roman.
Yeah, thank you, Martin. So I'm in agreement with view C. So I think a principle-based approach is necessary to really depict the substance of certain situations where components are bundled into one legal form, but from a substance point of view, we can isolate really single components, which also could be single contracts and are priced and managed separately. I think also if you look into the history of that paragraph, you can note in the, Francesco, you mentioned it, the February 2017 discussion, I think it gets transparent from that staff paper that in the review draft, paragraph 9 was drafted in a different way, basically handling not only the combination of contracts like now, but also the separation of contracts and pointing to a principle-based approach. According to the staff paper, that separation of components in the contract was taken out to not give the impression that you are in a kind of mandatory separation situation, but the intent was not to make the separation of contracts different from the approach to the combination of contracts. And I think based on that discussion and the agreement of the board in the February discussion on that staff paper, I read out of IFRS 17 paragraph 9 that also on the separation of insurance components of in one legal contract, a principle-based approach with reference to the framework was the intent of the board. So I think that is the reading I get of IFRS 17. From a practical perspective, it's highly relevant. There are more and more products bundled in a way that you in the interface to the customer combine then which things which could constitute a single contract into one contract for purposes of making it easy for the customer maybe to have only one contract with the different components, kind of bundled products. But the economic substance of that contract is that there are different components which interact not at all with each other, managed separately, also provide a completely different coverage, and in these situations, a more faithful presentation can be reached when separating them. And I would like to point out to one specific topic, which I think find quite helpful in the appendix in paragraph A4B. further discussion. I think on that example Klaff has drawn up here is assessing if for one contract, once you come to the conclusion that you have one contract which is not split up in components, if there could be different contract boundaries for the different not split components, and the staff conclusion is there is only one contract boundary for one contract, even if you have components with a different expectation about duration. I think that is quite important, and I fully agree to that view that there could be only one contract boundary for one contract. Otherwise, I don't know really how we could bring this into practice, and the results would be also quite onerous from my perspective, because in substance you would then require a split of contracts, and on which level, on which basis that should be done, I'm not so sure. Of course, the different expectations about renewals and expectations about the duration of cash flows should be taken into account, but at the very end there can only be one contract boundary. I fully agree. Thank you.
Thanks, Roman. Carlo?
Thank you. Just as an observation, and following on actually from the point that was just made about contract boundaries, I note that we're due to discuss coverage units later today, and indeed at the next meeting. And I wonder whether questions such as that of contract boundaries of coverage units and this may be sort of intertwined in some way, because depending on where we get to on this question, we do end up not separating components in certain situations. I would be interested to hear if that has an impact in terms of what we say about coverage units, for example. So I do support clarity. I'm an observer on this group. I support clarity on all of those questions and an understanding of how they interact with each other.
Thanks. And we have Anne.
Thank you. We discussed this issue in the Australian TRG, and there was a broad consensus with view C. We were very clear that we didn't really want any required separation, because there were numerous products which were a number of different risks within there, particularly in the general insurance industry and the reinsurance whole accounts. There were a lot of, across the globe, a lot of householders with a liability component, so there's very mixed types of risks within there, but in substance they were one contract and we didn't want required separation. But we did agree with UC that there are certain circumstances where the substance would indicate that you should separate, and that's where you've got clear management and distinct management of the different components. And we felt this would be quite clearly evident, so applying that judgment and that careful consideration that the staff had articulated was actually going to be relatively straightforward to do. It would be quite obvious where that would be the case. So we were comfortable with UC.
And Mary?
Thank you very much. Recognising the wide prevalence of bundled products, I would also be supportive of UC, provided it's made clear that it isn't a matter of accounting policy choice, it's principles-based. In that, I think one of the things that perhaps we could usefully do to support the board and staff is perhaps accumulate some more examples. So I found the example in the appendix extremely helpful. I think if we could accumulate some others, that would also help preparers in their interpretation. In that regard, two things I think that could usefully be discussed are that paragraph 2 clearly makes it clear that the definition of a contract requires the exercise of judgment. And I think that's something that could usefully be highlighted in those examples. And I think it is important to stress that what we're dealing with here is a little bit different. Well, it's fundamentally different from paragraph 24, where we're identifying cash flows at a higher level of aggregation and then applying them to the groups of contracts. But I think it's that point of trying to accumulate some more examples, I think, would be really helpful.
Massimo?
Thank you. No, I also agree and support view C, but at the same time, I guess, I also agree the view that you express in the appendix A. I guess that especially in the general insurance business, so in P&C, it's quite a common practice. So we have many examples that probably we can bring at this table, examples where, yes, we have one contract, but we have different, from a substance point of view, we are able and we manage and we conduct the business such a way. I also take the point of Roma that from a practical point of view, a different requirements, for example, the prohibition of separation would be very significant, because currently many business processes follow the different components of the contract. So for this kind of business, already the reserving process, the profitability measuring process are based on separating the components of the contract. And so I guess the VUC and would be more consistent on how currently part of the business, especially on GI, is managed. And so I support the VUC.
Sally?
Okay. I think my view is also support VUC, because we have some internal discussion. We read through the papers, like a staff view, although said it's not VUC, but we think it's quite like VUC, it's on principle basis. I think for the components in contract might be okay, because it's a single contract and the cash flow work together. But the problem is with riders. There do have some cases in our company and in our country that we do have some riders that can go with different contracts. They apply the same, and the cash flow are operated differently. Internally, it's totally managed differently in our account, and they are invested differently in different accounts. So in that case, that seemed to us there's two, although it's one single country in legal form, but it's different. And we also have some cases that you have two main contracts, but with one rider. There's like two contracts with one rider, then come together with one contract somehow. But these two main contracts are signed differently, but we have one rider with them. Either one will be terminated, the rider is still there. Only the case the two contracts terminated, the rider will go. So those might make things more difficult to consider which one, or would they be one contract or with two contracts together with the rider, or with separately, or how we go. So I might slightly agree with Mary, says that we need to correct more circumstances, because I think the real situation might be more complicated, especially the standards to all over the countries. There's a lot of different cases. So if the staff can agree that it's on principle basis and give some general guidance, instead of using the sample in this paper, because it looks like that it's not permitted, but this sample is quite simple and it's not reflect the real cases in some place. So I think if you remove the sample and give some general guidance, and we'll make the judgmental call, and I think that'd be better. That's my view.
Zhejong?
Thank you, Martin. I would like to add on to the comments regarding VUC as well as substance. Yeah. In AIA, we discussed this topic in some details. We believe the overall objective of IFRS 17 should be to reflect the substance and economics of the underlying insurance contract. If dissimilar risks are combined in a single contract, there may be instances where this does not provide useful information for users of the financial statement. As discussed in quite clearly in paragraph 21 and 22 of the paper, I believe preparers should have the flexibility to exercise judgment to represent the substance of the contract. We therefore support the VUC because we believe IFRS 17 should be principle-based.
Okay, thanks for that. Dara?
Just a couple of points. I think there's worth reminding everybody that VUC was obviously something that was expressed to us in the submission. And that clearly what we're trying to do here is not pick a particular view that we think is, what we're trying to do is interpret the standard. And I think that's an important thing. So just picking up a couple of the words that have gone around, I think Francesco actually probably summarized it best, is that the standard is based on a contractual basis, and those words about separation are not in the standard. So I think you do need to look at the standard and say, all right, VUC works as a principle based, but subject to the words in the standard. And the words in the standard start with a contract, and you only deviate from that contract, I think, if there is a real substance over form rider that comes. I think, Mary, your terminology about saying this is not a policy choice.
Yeah.
This is not something you can pick and choose on which way you want to go. So I think that's quite important. And then the other thing I just caution about at this stage, I think, is one thing we really, and Sally, I think you picked it up a little bit, we don't want to get into standard setting by example. And I think the real fear that we've got to be careful of is the more examples we throw at something, the more rules are going to fall out of the bottom. And as much as examples are useful in trying to understand what the concept is here, what the principles are here, I think actually having too many examples becomes very quickly counterproductive.
Thanks, Daryl. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Daryl, because this clarifies my view. I was stuck with the submission views presented, and I thought I cannot find myself in any of these views, because I fully agree with what is written in para 20. And when I read para 20, it's about that you stick with the contract, and when there is something artificially constructed, then you come to a different conclusion. But this is then, for me, not, as Mary pointed out, not a policy choice. This is then a requirement. If there is something artificially constructed to be combined in one contract, you need to separate, and it's not a choice to do so. So I cannot find myself in any of the views presented, but I fully understand these are the views presented by the submission. Must not necessarily, this is, might be, this, it leads you toward a conclusion. Therefore, I fully agree with what JP and also Kevin pointed out, that it's difficult to conclude on a specific view. And in order what Roman pointed out, I do think that, and this is in line with what Francesco pointed out, in the review draft there was something about separation, and there's an intentionally, for me there's an intention, if you leave it out, that the final standard is this intentionally, and therefore I stuck with what is written in para 20. So I don't think that any of the views would apply, but para 20 summarizes my understanding of what IFRS 17 requires.
Okay, Gail.
Thank you, Martin. I would agree with that, Jens. I was going to say, those who agree with VUC, I'm not sure what VUC means. So I would agree with the staff's analysis that this is not an accounting policy choice, and it depends what the contract is. My slight concern with that is, what does that mean? So having read the staff paper, I have heard a number of people say that I can unbundle, and a number of people saying it's a very high hurdle, I can rarely unbundle. And so I think the challenge is, when is it a requirement to unbundle? Now, and I agree with going to the conceptual framework, I just pause. If a standard is silent, we go through a hierarchy in IS 8. So one of the views I have heard is that before you get to the hierarchy, you would go to other standards, and you potentially would look to IFRS 15. One of the questions I have for the preparers and everyone doing this is when is that substance? When do you unbundle? And that's, when is it an interaction? Because I think one of the members mentioned it's when you manage it differently, or manage the different components. Well, that's quite loose. So I think I equally, though, I am very cautious about having more examples, because I think that is just that you can never do every example. So I'm trying to understand what we are all saying we think the standard says, and what does it really mean? Because I don't think we're all agreeing at the moment.
If I might just add something to help the discussion. So paragraph 23, for example, if we're looking at what we need to think about, we said that the mere fact that we combine different risk in one contract is not sufficient on its own to say that we need to separate contract. In the example, and I agree completely with what Daryl said, we don't need to conclude on every kind of example, but what we try to do is to flag what kind of considerations or criteria we might consider. So in this specific example, we ask ourselves, are the riders sold separately? Do they lapse together? So I think instead of going through different kind of examples, it might be helpful to hear from you what kind of criteria would be relevant in applying this judgment. So I think it's something similar to what Gail suggested.
Yeah, I mean, I have a view very similar to what Gail just voiced out, that we need to start with a standard, but we also need to look at the specific terms of a contract and also consider certain aspects that are flagged in the framework about how you make that decision, and they are to do with faithful representation and risks that underlie, you know, the various obligations, but also considering not only the way that you would account for the assets and obligations, but also for the corresponding income and expense. So you may end up in a situation, especially in the GI world, where you may have combined a short-term risk like household and a motor third-party liability. In one of the cases, you may end up having to discount and therefore have finance income and expense, and in the other not. And therefore, I think this is basically how, you know, at least that's what I hear industry looking at it and discussing. They are not in any way saying, oh, we must or we should or this is a policy choice. They're basically saying we need to analyse the underlying risks and what will be a faithful representation of the underlying risk and the way that we manage the contract. And also for regulatory purposes, in the majority of cases, these contracts are split. That's how they are reported and that's how they feed in capital calculations. And moreover, I mean, we've got the regulator here. For example, if you write a particular class of business, this may automatically put you into a minimum capital requirement threshold, which is different from, you know, another. And therefore, if you have a particular rider, for regulatory purposes, it will automatically push you into holding a minimum, absolute minimum threshold that is different if you view the contract as, let's say, simply household. So I think there needs to be a little bit more kind of broader principles-based view, but by all means starting from the from what the standard says. A contract is a contract, and then if, you know, accounting for it as a single piece will not be a faithful representation of the underlying risks, start looking at the hierarchy.
Kevin? Thank you. I think just coming back to paragraph 20 and I guess what I was worried about in it, and that's that sentence that says, therefore, a contract with the legal form of a single contract, unless artificially constructed this way, would generally be a single contract. I'm worried a little bit about those words, artificially constructed, because I think, you know, we're talking about where exactly is the boundary. Is it absolutely exceptional that you split it, or, you know, can it happen? And I think, Hagit, coming back to your point, that giving criteria about what you should consider is helpful. So I think the things that you've listed in this paper are helpful. So, you know, are they priced together? Do they come in different times? Do you manage them separately? Could you sell them separately? The reason I have a concern about artificially constructed is if you think of the reinsurance industry, they may have treaties, which are basically contracts which cover a very long period. Insurer could basically say, you know, in the next 5 years, if I start writing this line of business, then it'll start being ceded to you on a quota share basis. That contract may have different prices for those different lines of business. They may start and end at different times. They may be managed separately. They may be reported in a different regulatory way. And it feels like that's a contract that you could split. That feels like substance is telling you that, you know, it is multiple contracts. But I think the reinsurer wouldn't say, oh, I artificially constructed in one contract. They'd say, I put in one contract because that's how we do business. And so maybe picking up Mary's point, we may not need a lot of examples, but maybe one example where you say, yes, this is where you do separate, because your example here is where you don't, might give a bit of a, you know, theory about the boundaries of where you do and don't. And, you know, I think 20 restricts it a little bit too much.
Just building on what Kevin just said, I think the word artificial probably has connotations attached to it that we don't intend, because Joe's example she gave sounded like quite legitimate groupings of contracts, which I think is why Joe was objecting to the word substance as well, because I think it's coming with a stigma that sort of it's been done to sort of mask the reality or something like that, and I don't think that's what we intend. So I think that word artificial's got a message attached that we're not intending.
Francesco.
So now I'm interested in then what is it that you intend? Is it not? Because that's the thing, is that at this point I've heard so many things about guidance which is not written, and we're left with a standard that still doesn't say anything about it, we have to decide how to, well, say that we reach this judgment on based on the framework, then we need to decide how we're going to treat the cash flows, because portion of cash flows will go one way, another portion of cash flows go the other way. Two different CSMs, two different groups. Do I have a disclosure requirement in the framework? I don't think so. And Gail is right. Do I need to go straight to the framework because IFRS 17 is silent, or do I apply strictly the hierarchy which says first look for a standard that actually deals with that? And is that really fair to say that the ISB has written two standards only months apart? Because of the framework and the hierarchy, usually we use it as auditors when standards have been written years apart, and then there is clearly a need to use a hierarchy to close the loop. But I really struggle to believe that this is the case in this particular instance. So you've got to help us to understand where you want to go from this. Because what we hear here is that there is a lot of guidance, which is a good idea, but so far I've not seen it written.
Jerry?
So I think the standard is actually explicit by not dealing with it. It is essentially saying the contract is the contract is the contract. And I would respond to Gail too. I think that takes away the ability, and the history matters here, it takes away the ability to refer to another standard, because clearly in another standard we decided separation was applicable. In this case we said no, the contract is the contract. At the same time, I think what you bear in mind, and I think this is a universal thing, is that substance over form is a relevant issue in IFRS. And I think that's what you've been referred to here, is the universal substance over form discussion. And that's what you would need to look at in these circumstances. So, and I guess one of the useful things, and I wouldn't want to comment too much on substance over form, because one of the useful things about substance over form is it's not a new idea. It's been around for a while, people have a practice in dealing with it. But I think, to my mind, the standard is by not dealing with splitting is explicit that you don't split unless substance over form comes into play.
Mr. Leslie?
Thank you. We did discuss this at the Canadian Accounting Standards Board, TRG, and the message came through loud and clear that people don't want to be required to consider whether to separate or not. In other words, it should always be acceptable to use the contract as the single unit of account. So I was a little disturbed by Kevin's point about do versus don't. We would prefer to see it as can versus can't. Mm. Like it should be exceptional. That said, if you do make the exception, it would feel like you should always use the same principles in your company for deciding when to separate or not, so it almost becomes a slippery slope. Is it okay to never separate, but then once you decide you need to separate under certain conditions, you must separate under the same conditions? Or is it, I agree, it's still unclear. I would also, I had one point on, to comment on Roman's point. I would think if you did separate, like if you believe the substance over form was exceptionally different enough that you should separate, that those two could have different boundaries. Yes. Thank you. Yes. That was unclear.
So,
well, I think I'm hoping I'll look at Daryl as I say this in case he gives me a look that says shut up. I would hope that the example that Joe used would be a good case of where we would think we would want people to separate and look beyond the single document, to use a neutral term which Martin used, because Joe gave the example, hopefully I don't misspeak, of a convenience of I've got one customer and for them and us it's easier to document, I don't know, dog insurance and life insurance are the two extremes we always use, in one contract, just so there's one place where there's a document. But clearly they're two different things, and particularly if they're priced in exactly the same way as it would have been a separate dog and life contract, but we've just stuck them in one document. That would seem to be a case where it would be fairly artificial if we were to say simply because there's a single piece of paper, you have to treat that as a single thing. That, I think, is a good example of when you would say, come on, guys, that's not really, I think you said that's not really a single contract the way
we... That is what I ask it. Is it really a single contract?
Or
is a single contract bundled in one contract and does not make any difference? But I think if it makes a big difference, if you have given big discounts for this bundling, I think then it becomes difficult, and then it is a kind of even more difficult, and then I think our guidance is, okay, the contract is a contract, because that is what my personal view, because we were concerned and also guided by the industry, it is difficult to split cash flows. And that is a guiding principle was for me, saying, okay, if we have split cash flows, that is too difficult, therefore let's account for the contract as a contract. But if there is not any difference between if you have the contract separated, because I took the example which my own insurance is, okay, I have car, house, whatever in one contract, but I think it was okay not giving a discount for that, it was okay that make it easy for me that I have to send only one signed letter back, and therefore I think in this kind of circumstances is different. But okay, that was, and next is Laurent.
Thank you, Martin. Yeah. I might be part of a minority in this room, but I would tend to favor VOD. This is because initially we was in favor of UC, but then coming back to the comment on Kevin on paragraph 20, my concern was about the possible restriction in terms of what would be an artificial contract and having insufficient leeway in terms of overriding the contract level presumption. It is true, Martin, that in general we would want to project cash flow for cover simultaneously, and we would like to avoid an excessive level of granularity. Nevertheless, there might be instances where separating would be necessary for business and for operational reasons. And I would also like to point out that when covers are sold in a bundled manner, it might be that in one given market, it makes sense to have things reflected in the financial statements globally, but there might be other markets where it makes sense to separate. I'm thinking, for instance, about bundled sale of death, disability, and health covers. You might want to have that globally in certain markets, and you might want in certain markets to separate out the health company.
Thanks. Joe?
Yeah, just a couple of points. I mean, I think it's if there was a requirement not to separate, I think that could be just as problematic, because you could bolt things together to shelter one loss-making and one profitable and overall profit. So I think that, you know, that is just as problematic a situation. And then, and the other thing I wanted to just pick up on was the point on cash flows and the ability to separate them. And from my perspective, that really depends on, is there interdependencies in the measurement of the components of the contract? You know, many of the contracts that I'm talking about, where we are, for want of a better term, we're bolting together components for a proposition that suits that particular customer. There will be one contract, there will be one direct debit, but we can split those. That's not a problem. It's when there's interdependencies on the measurements and there's diversification between the components, and we're charging a price on that basis. It's the diversification that you can't easily split in the cash flows.
Thanks for that, Sally.
And also adding with your point about the cash flow, as I just said, in all cases, it's not for this accounting treatment purpose to separate the cash flow. In many cases, the cash flow are going to different accounts. They're automatically and normally just being operated separately, because some are, for example, the riders on participating products and the main contracts are traditional. They're in totally different account, our investment contracts. So that means that if the cash flow can be split, they're managed or separately, that would be a good example to support the judgment call to do the separating. That's actually my question.
Yeah, just adding on to what Joe said, because again, here in the UK, the practice in that type of contract is that you've got separate deductibles for the separate risks and separate limits. You've got a separate premium that is charged for the different risks. So from a separation point of view of the cash flows, it is easy, it can be done, and it is done. I absolutely agree, it's a different story if you've got a common limit, and therefore it becomes a little bit more complicated, you know, from a measurement perspective. But in the majority of the cases, they are very easily separated.
And
I think there are quite a few reinsurance treaty examples where you have multiple risks and they have multiple limits and they're not easily separated, and they're intended to be one contract. So I think, you know, that's that's quite a different perspective. But I think they're also, and I fully agreed with what Roman said earlier, that, you know, we have contracts where they are just bolted together because you're facilitating the consumer's desire to have two very different contracts, like the dog, the life one. So, you know, they're the ones where you really should have the ability, after due consideration, to split them and show them separately. And so I think that's quite different to, you know, you can't just align that with the multiple limits, because they are implicit within complex and, you know, significant reinsurance and direct in, general insurance treaties as well.
Okay.
Just a very small addition to that on reinsurance, because very often on reinsurance treaties you've got the various layers priced separately. And again, on that basis, there could be an argument to separate, because the expectation of the nature of the risk is different, although this is the same legal contract. Again, something to consider.
Okay. So it seems that a lot of judgment is necessary to answer that question. But Hegit, I think you...
Let's try to recap and pick up the most key messages, so we will be helpful to our listeners. So what I hear, I think generally there is general agreement with the analysis in terms of, we start with a contract, IFRS 17 start with a contract, and it's built up for a contract. If the substance of that contract is different, so it reflects two separate contracts, something that we need to consider. So we apply judgment considering all relevant facts and circumstances before we say that a legal contract is not a contract in substance. I think we all kind of agree this is not a pick and choose, this is not a policy choice, it does not depend on whether it's easy to separate or it's difficult to separate. It really depends, I think, on the substance of the contract. I picked up in terms of examples, I think that there, I heard a lot of agreement with the example and the criteria that we used in our example in the staff paper. So we should look at whether there is interdependency between risk included in a certain contract. If they lapse together, if the risks are sold separately, is something to consider. I heard, I think, going back to what Joe mentioned, another example of where it might be appropriate to separate, because a substance of the legal contract is actually the same substance of having multiple separate contracts, because just for convenience reason we go and sign off one contract. So this is a good example. I think I picked up the key messages.
Any concerns about that?
So any key messages anybody thinks we've missed, because that's what will be in the summary essentially. Mm-hmm.
And just one question. So that does mean it is required in some...
Yes.
In some... That's the substance.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Sorry to keep talking about this, but will we also take artificial out of the...
So artificial would not be included in the summary, short term. We'll not use it in the summary. Okay, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Thank you.